Park Place, Wednesday afternoon, 15th May 1974.
This is our final meditation meeting before we go away from here tomorrow. I hope that during these days we have had a slightly deeper insight into the significance and the meaning of meditation. Meditation in its full sense means the state of communion, the state of constant communion. It is the state in which the individual, the separate individual, is restored to full relationship with the totality. A state which is the permanent ground of his awareness throughout the day, all 24 hours of the day. And I trust we have seen the importance of mindfulness in all this, and we have seen the difference between meditation as ordinarily understood and practiced, namely the discursive meditation, where one deliberately goes through a mental process which has psychological results. The distinction between that and that other aspect, which is the peak point of meditation, when one transcends the discursive process altogether. And this new kind of awareness, this new kind of consciousness comes into being, accompanied by the complete maturity of the mind. We here can only practice the ordinary discursive meditation. I think you will have noticed from this morning's considerations that the crucial point when one changes over from discursive meditation into meditation proper in the profound sense, the deep sense, is when the flow of discursive thought and words is completely pacified, not suppressed, not repressed, but completely pacified because of one's own real inner development. The state of calm is established, and this new mode of being flowers out. You have heard me say it so often, perhaps you might be a bit impatient, but I'll say it again. The fundamental basis is morality. The simple commandments of the Judeo-Christian tradition, the simple triad as presented in Zarathustrianism, good thoughts, good words, good deeds. What the Buddha used to call right conduct of body, speech, and mind. There are the simple sealers, the precepts or advices. And in Buddhism, for instance, we have the first emphasis laid upon harmlessness. To abstain from onslaught, as it is translated, on creatures. That is the simplest statement. When the Buddha develops it, if you study the Brahmajala Sutta, you will begin to see the tremendous implications of this. And when you add to this the fact which is emphasized strongly in the Shandilya Upanishad, that in body, speech and mind one is harmless, you will see the immense implications of harmlessness. And so too with every other virtue. It is a wonderful practice for each and every one of us to be mindful of the thoughts and feelings that pass through us throughout the day. The petty annoyances, the little uprising of anger, the little uprising of criticism, of impatience, and so on, to strong feelings about something or someone, and how we burst out in hate, in thought and feeling, thereby harming both ourselves and that against which our emotion or thought has arisen. And how many times we slay a person in thought. Again and again this happens throughout life. You know how a child, for instance, just bursts out, "I wish you were dead." And we laugh at it and say, "Oh, that's just childishness." But Let us take heed. How often do we feel as the child feels, but with real venom in our minds and hearts when we are grown up? These are things which we should bear in mind constantly. The whole of life is a most marvelous field, a most marvelous opportunity for mindfulness over the simplest things. Take the next sila, to refrain from taking what is not given. I like to slightly expand that and say, not to take, I'll put it in its positive form, to take only that which is given freely and with love. It is very difficult to give freely and with love. If one is ever really awake and conscious to all one's inner motives and all one's unconscious working, one discovers how ungiving we are. If we succeed in becoming really giving, then the occasion to forgive or forget never arises. We are giving all the time quite freely. We withhold nothing. There are no reservations. And we give quietly, we give graciously. And that too is the art of accepting a gift. To accept graciously that which is given purely, freely, lovingly. I think it was the other evening after dinner when we were talking here, or it may have been some other occasion, when I mentioned my meeting that very remarkable Sikh who lives in Bias in India. He is the head of his particular group of people, and his particular group is not a small group like ours now. The movement has spread over the world, and there are literally thousands of them in the different continents of the world. And I was with him in the beginning of 1961 for 6 days. And I observed one extraordinarily interesting thing about him. None of us was there except as his guest. He would take nothing from us whatsoever. And he himself earned his own living, managing his estates, paying his people well, and he would accept support in terms of money or whatever else it may be. He would accept it only from certain sources. He had great sensitivities, deep perception. We would, just to use a word loosely, he had a sort of a psychic penetration. He knew whether that money came from a pure source, whether it was clean money. And if he felt it isn't clean, he would not take it. And he would refuse it in the most gracious way, in the kindest possible manner. I'm saying these things just to suggest what an enormous amount is involved in the simple moralities. With regard to the third morality, which we could translate into modern terms simply by saying to abstain from all sensuous self-indulgence. This does not mean to abstain from the normal pleasures and so on of the senses, which will inevitably come to us. Look at this beautiful day, full of sunshine and beauty. It's a pleasure. It's a happiness. Yes, take it with both hands. It's the gift of the infinite. Not that, but the grasping after them. The indulging of the self because it is pleasant and it is the opposite of the unpleasant. That is what we have to abstain from. Take that fourth precept which touches speech. And I think you've heard enough during these 8 days from me, 7 days from me, regarding speech. It's very interesting that the Buddha emphasizes the necessity for abstaining from speech that is lying, slanderous, malicious, rude, slang speech, and he emphasizes and exhorts his bhikkhus to speak graciously, with good manners. He even uses the word speech that is urbane, pleasing to the ear, and so forth. And in the Zarathustrian Gathas, you find one of the blessings asked for from Ahura Mazda himself, grant sweetness of speech. Well, now we have dealt with that quite a bit during these days. And if you look at the fifth sila, the fifth precept, to abstain from all intoxicants. Of course, specifically spirituous liquors are mentioned. But in modern times, I think we would have rather a larger list where intoxicants, narcotics, and such things are concerned. Beware of the excuse that I am a scientist experimenting with chemicals or whatever they are in order to make a trip and discover something about the deep states of consciousness. The deep states of consciousness will certainly not be discovered that way. The deep states of stupidity will be indulged in. So you see, these simple moralities contain such an enormous amount in them. And perhaps we might use just this as our subject for meditation now. Harmlessness, to abstain from doing harm. We say, love thy neighbor. But what is love? How do I positively love? But what I can positively do is abstain from that which is not love. Hurting another, jealousy, ambition, envy, and all the rest of it, violence and so forth. That I know from my actual everyday experience. This other thing which is love is everlastingly a shining star in the heavens, and it remains away from me until I myself, by the spiritual alchemy of mindfulness, have become that star myself. And then I don't know that I am the star. Go around the universe and ask the stars, who are you? And the star will just continue to shine. And that's all the answer you will get. So now, choose harmlessness if you like, to abstain from doing harm. Choose the second one, to refrain from taking what is not given freely and lovingly. Take only that which is given freely and lovingly, and accept it graciously. Or take abstention from self-indulgence of the senses, or speech, still, if you like, or intoxicants. Please yourself.
When meditation is rightly carried out, the whole organism becomes restful. It is free of strains and stresses. You know how in everyday life, when the body gets tired with activity, there is the tendency to yawn and go to sleep. We explain it by saying insufficient oxygen, which is perfectly true, that insufficient oxygen is considerably due to the fact that the rhythm of life has been disturbed, suppressed. The rhythm of life in its wholeness, and that rhythm in its particular aspect of breathing, has been upset, Therefore, we need more oxygen, as we say. When you practice meditation quietly by yourselves, just notice afterwards what is the state of the body. And this is where the discipline of yoga, the asanas, the postures, is a very great help. It enables the body to be at ease, and the breath rhythm to coordinate perfectly with that easy state of the body.